From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today, the Food and Drug Administration and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention called for a pause in the Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine distribution out of an abundance of caution after several people who got the shots developed a rare blood clot disorder within 2 weeks. Here's Acting FDA Commissioner Dr. Janet Woodcock this morning.
Right now, I'd like to stress these events appear to be extremely rare. However, COVID-19 vaccine safety is a top priority for the federal government.
Well, scientists from the FDA and CDC will meet tomorrow to review the data, decide whether they should limit authorization of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. But what should we all do? Joining us on Skype, Dr. Peter Hotez, co-director of the Center for Vaccine Development at Texas Children's Hospital, dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine. Dr. Hotez, almost 7 million shots of the J&J vaccine have been given so far. Six people are known to have developed a blood clot disorder 6 to 13 days after they were vaccinated. Now, to those people, of course, that's all that matters. But to a lot of people, that doesn't sound like a big risk. You say what?
Well, I think there's a few reasons for the pause in the announcement. One is because cerebral thrombosis is a pretty severe event that's life-threatening, and the management of it is different from the way we ordinarily deal with clotting, which is we give heparin. In this case, you don't want to give heparin, so it's to alert the healthcare community that if somebody comes in with a cerebral thrombotic event, to administer a different approach to treatment. I think that was fairly important. Also, with that alert, there may be more cases identified, so we can determine if it really is one per million or closer to what is being said about the AstraZeneca vaccine, which is another adenovirus-based vaccine, which is around 1 in 100,000, 1 in 250,000. So it is stated as an abundance of caution. But it is interesting that both of the major adenovirus vectored vaccines, the AstraZeneca vaccine and the J&J vaccine, seem to be doing the same thing. So there's a lot of discussions going on now between the FDA and the European regulators where the AstraZeneca vaccine has been rolled out.
Yeah, people can be forgiven for saying, wait, we knew this already, but that's because we heard this about the AstraZeneca vaccine in Europe, and the Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca vaccines are both the adenovirus vaccines, as you say. Without making our heads explode, can you briefly remind us what that means?
So the mRNA vaccines from Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech are just that. They're a piece of mRNA in a lipid envelope. In this case, the AstraZeneca vaccine and the J&J vaccine are a non-replicating virus vaccine. It's the adenovirus, a DNA virus, that delivers the spike protein, or at least the gene for the spike protein to the body, and then it's produced. And so they're different adenovirus vaccines, so they're not the same. So the AstraZeneca is a chimpanzee adenovirus. The J&J vaccine, which was developed at Harvard Medical School and Beth Israel Deaconess Hospital, is a Ad26 vector vaccine. So there are some differences as well.
Yeah. Well, so different delivery systems. And as you're saying, one of the reasons to do this pause is to get the word out that people might be having this effect of this, but it should be treated differently. But are we positive that those blood clots are from the J&J shots?
We don't know. But I think there was enough there that the FDA wanted to put things on pause and give them time to investigate it and discuss it with other regulators and get their arms around it. So there was enough of a safety signal or flare, and the fact that we do have two other COVID-19 vaccines out there. So it's not like the whole COVID-19 vaccination program has to halt. So it's all about benefit versus risk. And on that basis, they thought that it was prudent to pause at this point.
Right. And people are being directed, to go to these other shots, Pfizer, Moderna. But if you had a J&J vaccine, what should you do? What are you looking for to think maybe you might have a side effect?
Well, first of all, don't panic. It's important to stress this is a really rare event, right? We're talking, we think, around one per million. So this is not a reason to panic. But the fact that it has been seen overwhelmingly in premenopausal women. If you fit that category, then just be mindful. And what it means is, in a week or between 1 and 2 weeks after you've gotten the shot, if you are having prolonged and severe headache, you definitely want to go seek medical attention. Or if you're having evidence of blood clots in your lower leg, leg pains or chest pains, then you want to take appropriate measures and see your healthcare provider. But it's important to stress that this is an uncommon event.
No panicking. Dr. Peter Hotez, co-director of the Center for Vaccine Development at Texas Children's Hospital and dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
President Biden is calling for a complete investigation into the shooting death of Dante Wright, a black man killed over the weekend by a police officer during a traffic stop. The officer is shown on video saying she mistakenly shot Wright instead of using a taser. Here's the president speaking yesterday at the White House.
We're calling for peace and calm, and we should listen to Dante's mom, who is calling for peace and calm.
It was not calm in Brooklyn Center last night, with police clashing with protesters there for a second night. And let's bring in Julian Zelizer, our professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, for more on the president's remarks and the push for federal police reform. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Julian, President Biden's message is kind of a reminder of the president's role during times like this. They historically serve as a symbol of unity to give a message that helps the country unite. But this issue of police use of force, this constant killing of black men and women by police, at this point, a lot of Americans are feeling it's going to take a lot more than words. Just a few days ago, we learned the White House is putting the creation of a National Police Oversight Commission on hold. So, Julian, at this point, what is the president's role in the context of this call for federal police reform?
Look, it's important for the president to build support for reform and to use the bully pulpit to get on the right side of a debate. But the Department of Justice needs to be involved in tackling these questions at the state and local level. We do need possibly federal investigation or commissions. And finally, this has to be on the president's legislative agenda. It's as urgent as the American Rescue Plan or the infrastructure bill. And I think this would be an important step for Biden to take in the coming months.
Yeah, and as we know, national police reform legislation in the U.S. Congress has stalled. How have past presidents, I'm thinking of Kennedy and Johnson specifically, responded to moments of racism when the force of the federal government was needed to enforce civil rights, for example?
Well, they used the bully pulpit. In March 1965, Lyndon Johnson spoke before Congress and the nation, calling on the country to embrace the cause of voting rights after civil rights protesters had been brutally beaten. They also used the DOJ. Even John F. Kennedy, who was very slow on civil rights legislation, did authorize DOJ to deal with integration in the University of Mississippi and Alabama and to start protecting civil rights protesters. And finally, they deal with it through legislation. Johnson followed up his speech after Bloody Sunday, not just with words, but with a voting rights bill that changed national policy. So they really need to work on all three realms simultaneously.
One thing I think you're referring to is the Kerner Commission. And that commission's report said that poverty and institutional racism were the driving causes of inner city violence. That report came out in 1968. I mean, what did it recommend and how is it applicable to today?
It recommended changing policing, less militarization of the police, more policing training, dealing with racism in the forces. And it also dealt with called for a Marshall Plan for the cities to end unemployment and create economic vitality. The problem was it came as conservatives were regaining power, and Johnson, President Johnson, felt there was nothing he could do. So he doesn't really move forward with legislation. And Richard Nixon instead moves toward law and order. I think we can look back to the report. Biden can do that to see just how systemic and just how long-term these problems with policing are. And that just amplifies the need for a federal role in changing what citizens experience.
You know, every time there's something like a police shooting, we talk with you about this, Julian. I mean, knowing the history of this country and what we've been dealing with, where do you see this moment that we're at now? Do you think that we're at a moment where we're going to see real change in a measurable way?
I don't know. I mean, the history suggests that reform isn't very easy, and we go through these moments and nothing happens. I mean, the only positive developments are we do have a president who seems to be willing to be bold right now. He's doing things on other areas of policy that people said was impossible. And we also have a very vibrant Black Lives Matter movement that expanded greatly after the George Floyd killing that can keep putting pressure on legislators from the bottom up. So those are the sources that provide some optimism, in addition to corporate support for
ending voting restrictions. Julian, I'm going to have to stop you because we've run out of time. But thank you, Julian Zelizer, Princeton University, as always. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
The racial reckoning in this country continues after a traffic stop outside Minneapolis, another in Virginia. It's going on in courtrooms, corporations, a demand for a clear-eyed look at systemic racism, which exists no matter how many white people say they know black people, love black people, adopt black people. Yes, a reckoning in mixed-race adoptions is playing out on the wildly popular TV show This Is Us. In this flashback scene, a preteen Randall, who is black, confronts his formerly blue-collar, loving, white adoptive dad, Jack, who's taken him to play golf. Randall reminds his dad they once went to a martial arts dojo.
Do you remember that dojo that we went to a few years back with all the other black families?
Yeah.
We went a few times, but then we stopped.
You said you didn't want to learn karate anymore.
Yeah, but you won't let me quit soccer or baseball. You don't want me to quit golf.
I don't quite follow you here, Randall.
You just don't get it.
What don't I get?
What you said before about feeling weird at some country club golf course.
Okay.
You felt uncomfortable at a golf course, and I probably wouldn't have even been allowed on it.
I don't look at you and see color. I see my son.
Then you don't see me, Dad.
Mm. That's our next guest reacting to that scene from This Is Us. And well-meaning, loving, white, liberal adoptive parents who fail their black children are also the subject of Rebecca Carroll's searing new memoir, Surviving the White Gaze, about growing up the only black person in her town in rural New Hampshire. Her parents also said they didn't see color. Her white birth mother actively undermines her blackness. And Rebecca Carroll joins us now. And first, have I got that about right? My summation.
Yeah.
And I think I heard a hue when you were listening to the This Is Us scene.
Yes, yes. Which, I mean, might as well have been me in that conversation. But Randall had the wherewithal, whereas I really struggled to sort of have the language to contextualize that I felt like I wasn't seen.
Yeah. Well, let's stay with you and who you were as a child. There's a couple of early references that just break my heart. A teacher in grade school tells you you're pretty. And then she says, you know, for a black girl, because usually they're ugly.
Yeah. So, I mean, here's the thing. The cognitive dissonance was enormous because my parents and their sort of white liberal artist friends all thought that I was really beautiful. You know, I was precocious and I loved to dance and to perform and I loved fashion. And so I thought that I was beautiful. And so when my teacher said that I was pretty, what I internalized was what she said afterwards, right? Was that most black girls are ugly, very unattractive. I remember distinctly the way she scrunched up her face. The seed had been planted where I was like, wait a minute, something is awry here.
Yeah.
My white adoptive parents sort of raised us in this bucolic bubble, beauty and art and fresh flowers and tea. And so when we left that bubble, you know, my brother and sister, who are my parents' biological children, sort of went about their business, wherein I, within 2 years of leaving that bubble, am suddenly the target of racism.
Well, the Pearson family in This Is Us, they think they're doing the right thing. We don't see color.
Right.
And you're saying, I need you to see my color.
Yes, because the message therein is the only way I will love you or find you valuable is if I strip you of something that is so integral to your identity. But then it's also saying we're not thinking about the way in which the world is perceiving you and the way that this country has been killing people who look like you.
Look, we'll take up some of these heavy issues, but there's also the practical ones. What to do with your hair? And mm-hmm. you were 6 years old when you first met your first fellow Black person. This is a ballet yeah. teacher that you adored. She mm-hmm. knew these things. She knew, you know, your skin might get ashy, and she knew about skin creams and makeup and hair. And she inspired your very first essay. You wrote, "My name is Rebecca Ann Carroll, and I am a Black child."
I remember that I had to write it down, and that that was maybe one of the earliest moments, if not the first moment, where I turned to writing as a way to make things real. But in that particular moment, it was me telling myself or my family or whoever was going to read it that I'm Black. I had to tell myself that.
Yeah. Well, and that world that they didn't warn you about was right outside your door. There's a boyfriend's father who won't allow any prom pictures of him with you?
He was not a boyfriend. I never had boyfriends because all of the white boys,
that's right,
their parents wouldn't allow them to date me. So this
okay,
was just a friend.
A guy who goes to the prom with you, right? Yeah, right,
yeah.
Right. Is this also the teacher?
He was our history teacher. One day we were talking about slavery and the benefits of slavery to capitalism. And I raised my hand and I said, but is the dehumanization of people really worth it? Something along those lines. And he said, well, see, now that's your problem. Black people don't know how to think right. Like, and even his sentence was like grammatically incorrect, right? And I just remember being so stunned by that.
In addition to a family at home that, by the way, you know, they didn't want to see color. They also probably didn't see a lot of things. They also were practicing open marriages. They didn't have a lot of time, it sounds like. You weren't grounded in anything. So that's another aspect of your family. But then you meet your birth mom. And it was stunning to hear this white birth mother do the opposite of your parents. She seemed to only see your color and belittled you for it. She called you a token. She said people are making you exotic and they're making you think you're special and you're really not. Mm-hmm. I can't. Mm-hmm. What was that about?
I mean, I have really tried to decenter her in my brain and in my life. And so what I was able to do and to write about regarding her is on the pages of the memoir. But as I've written, you know, she clearly was unhappy with who I presented myself as when we reunited at 11, by the way, which was way too young. I just wanted to know her and be in her orbit. She was so beautiful and charismatic, but she was also harshly judgmental and, you know, sort of decided that she was the authority on what it meant to be Black, and I did not fit that bill. It was a very, very toxic relationship.
Difficult to read. What impact did you think your whole childhood, adoptive parents who couldn't see your color, a birth mother who derided it, you know, the only Black child in a whole town. What impact did that have?
I think that I learned how to navigate a white world and learned to trust my instinct that I wanted to be in a Black world because I am Black. There were early, early yearnings and instincts, and there was nobody to sort of engage with me and to encourage me to follow those instincts. That took a great toll. And in my 20s, I was just treading water the whole time, trying to get out from under this white gaze. And by the time I caught wind of freedom, when I heard Toni Morrison use that phrase, the white gaze, I was exhausted.
You suffered depression, excessive drinking, suicidal thoughts. This was tough. Then you find Toni Morrison. You find a Black community in college. What are you saying for the white families hearing this now? They're going to read the book, I know, maybe recognizing, what didn't I do for my mm-hmm. Rebecca. What can they do?
Well, the first thing is to lean into that six to your stomach feeling, because that's the right feeling to have. And if you sit long enough in that feeling, you're going to find a way out of it, because nobody wants to feel that way.
Mm. Well, you're now married to a white man who's devoted his career to studying race. You have a son. I'm imagining there are the books of Zora Neale Hurston, maybe the photography of Gordon Parks, you know. Is that what it is for, and again, this should not be your responsibility to tell white parents how to do best for their adoptive black children, but is it not just leaning into that in your stomach, but jumping into the black culture for your children?
No, it's definitely not jumping into it for your children. It's jumping into it with your children. And it's less about drawing attention to blackness for a white parent's self. It is living amid blackness as a way of helping to give that and recognize that within their black children. That is parenting.
Are you saying, it doesn't sound like you are, that you don't think white parents should adopt black children?
No, that's not what I'm saying at all. But I do. I have a piece in the Washington Post that is advice. You know, there are very particular things you should ask yourself before adopting black children, i.e., do you have any black people in your life? If you don't, think about that first. Mm. I'm not certainly discouraging it. I am asking white adoptive parents to think deeply and engage deeply with blackness, black culture, black history, and to consider that integral part of their parenting.
That's culture critic and essayist Rebecca Carroll. Her new memoir, Surviving the White Gaze, about growing up in a well-meaning liberal family in rural white New Hampshire. Rebecca, thank you so much. I read it in about, oh my gosh, one long night. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And we'll link you to her op-ed. And we'd love to hear your thoughts, because this is probably hitting home for a lot of people. So if you've navigated interracial adoption as a child or a parent, please send us an email at letters@hereandnow.org. President Biden wants to invest $50 billion in the semiconductor chip industry, part of a broader plan to address a global shortage that's squeezing supply chains, and also part of his plan to get Americans to expand their notion of what it means to build. During a virtual White House summit with tech CEOs yesterday, he made the case for the funding being part of the administration's infrastructure bill.
Chips like the one I have here, these chips, these wafers, our batteries, broadband, it's all infrastructure. This is infrastructure. So look, we need to build the infrastructure of today, not repair the one of yesterday.
Let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Robin Young, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you? We haven't talked in a while. Good to speak with you. The two Robins. Well, this proposed funding is aimed at preventing another chip shortage. We've talked about shortages, but what's being done now to address the one that we're having?
There's a whole lot of hand-wringing and confusion, and President Biden is trying to exhort whatever domestic production we have, which you can't exactly turn on overnight. You remember toilet paper, pickles, chicken wings, but the idea that there would be a shortage of semiconductors denting the production of cars into a hot market a year into the pandemic, I mean, you're hearing more and more buyers paying above sticker price now. That idea was out of left field. The car makers, Robin, they did what you think would be the rational thing in the throes of the crisis, to slash their orders for these chips. Now they can't make enough to meet demand, and they're furloughing workers and idling plants.
Yeah, they're shutting down assembly lines. What by the way, impact is that having on the car industry?
Yeah, even though the car makers globally, they represent at most, you know, a sliver of chip demand, maybe 5%. The U.S., you know, it only produces around 12% of these components. And you put it all together, and GM is saying, we see a $2 billion hit to profits this year, Ford as much as $2.5 billion. Globally, I saw an estimate that this is going to cost automakers across the planet north of $60 billion. So it's definitely material.
So President Biden wants to ramp up U.S. manufacturing to rely less on these international chip makers. There's just, you know, two firms, one in Taiwan and another in South Korea, that control more than 70% of the market. But how did the U.S. get so far behind?
Well, we know a major story of the past 30 years, and especially the 20 years since China came up to the World Trade Organization, really it's been the seeding of manufacture of all manner of electronics and semiconductors to Asia. China has made this sector a quasi-public national champion for almost 50 years. The U.S. consumer was happy to snap up, you know, very cheap Chromebooks and smartphones, $300 flat-screen TVs, but it was never imagined that chips for cars would be such a choke point. But I think the lesson is the more you skimp on inventory here as a manufacturer and the more the nation is okay with relying on foreign manufacturers for essential parts, the more likely you are to face a bottleneck just like this one.
Yeah. And you mentioned China just very briefly. How is that playing into the broader tensions between the U.S. and China?
Well, I think it's fascinating that both Taiwan and China can use this as a wedge versus the United States. The latter doesn't want the U.S. and Taiwan any more cozy. China, which is a first-line manufacturer, this could be used as a carrot or a stick in its face-off with the U.S. And Biden, you know, he's exhorting more manufacturing self-determination here. And so yeah. Intel is stepping up, but it's doubtful that any of that is going to come online in the near term.
Well, Robin Farzad, we got through all of that without saying the chips are down. Robin is host
Welcome
of Public
back.
Radio's.
Welcome back, Robin.
Good to speak with you. Host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Check that out. Robin, thank you.
Thank you.
Iran's foreign minister warned today that the attack on its main nuclear enrichment site will impact ongoing talks with the United States to rejoin the Iran nuclear deal. The U.S. insists it had nothing to do with the sabotage on Sunday. Borzu Daragahi is international correspondent for The Independent, and he joins us now from Istanbul. He's on Skype with the latest. And Borzu, what is going on there? Media reports out of Israel are saying Israel is responsible for this attack. Is it connected to these upcoming talks?
Well, I think that the planning for this type of operation, it's at least months, if not years. What I think is interesting is the fact that Israel didn't call off the attack despite the talks that are resuming this week. And so I think that's the most that we can say. Is it linked to the – was the attack linked to the talks? Probably not. Was the fact that they didn't call off the attack linked to the talks? Probably.
Borzu, I just want to make certain that I'm clear on motive here with Israel potentially taking responsibility for this attack. We know that Iran is Israel's biggest strategic threat, but can you lay out for us more on why, what the motive might have been in light of the fact that these talks are upcoming? I understand what you're saying about this might have been years in the making or months in the making, but just to get clarity for those who don't know the history here.
I mean, the motive is Israel does not want the revival of the nuclear deal. They don't want Iran and the U.S. to have even the semblance of normalized relations. There are a number of different theories as to why Israel does not want this. Benjamin Netanyahu says that Iran cannot be trusted and that the nuclear deal will help Iran assemble the components to a nuclear program, even as the nuclear deal puts limits on Iran's nuclear program. There's others who speculate that Israel's real motive is just to prevent any kind of diplomatic rapprochement between the United States and Iran, as that would damage Israel's standing in the Middle East. It would give the U.S. an opportunity to not focus so much on the Middle East and perhaps move some of its military assets out of the Middle East. And that would be a threat to Israel and its posture and its tremendous strategic advantages in the Middle East.
How does this compromise the Biden administration's desire to restore this deal? Does Iran want the U.S. back in this deal?
Iran wants the sanctions removed. Iran wants its frozen assets that include billions in dollars held in bank accounts abroad, wants them released. Iran would like, but it's not a deal killer, access to the dollarized banking system that has been elusive to it so that it can conduct transactions for the things that it needs and for its exporters, for its oligarchs to become wealthy and powerful and so on. They can't do that without access to the international banking system. And it's a problem for their exporters. It's a problem for their importers. And it, destabilizes to some extent the support for the regime. What the attack like this does, it poisons the diplomatic atmosphere. Just imagine, you know, these guys coming back to Vienna on Wednesday after such a thing has happened, Iran's most sensitive nuclear site hit by a sabotage attack that was, you know, most likely carried out by one of the U.S.'s closest partners. So that, I think, definitely sours the mood when those guys sit down and talk.
Can you lay out for us how much this attack has impacted, potentially impacted or affected this program, Iran's program?
We have no idea. I mean, they've not disclosed that. The Iranian government acknowledged that some centrifuges were damaged. And occasionally when one of these centrifuges busts or breaks, they bring out one of the old ones to replace it. So, you know, we're 300 centrifuges damaged. Will Iran quickly replace those 300? Or did it disrupt a kind of key component of the infrastructure of the facility so that it'll take longer? We don't know. They've not disclosed that.
Borzu Daragahi is international correspondent for The Independent. Thank you so much for this update.
It's been a pleasure.
Ramadan this year may look a little more like years past. A massive vaccination effort has been underway leading up to the Islamic Holy Month, which began last night in the U.S., in part so that Muslims can gather and pray together at mosques. In Minnesota, for example, Muslim leaders led an aggressive campaign and are reporting success with nearly 7,000 vaccines administered across 16 mosques. Imam Asad Zaman helped secure those vaccines. He's the executive director of the Muslim American Society of Minnesota, and he joins us now. Imam Zaman, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Were you finding at all what others have reported, members who were hesitant, not sure that they wanted to get the vaccine? And what did you do to address their concerns, if so?
Well, yes, we found several who were eager to get the vaccine and several who were hesitant to get the vaccine. So I'll give as an example, the first day we did it, we had two clinics of 500 vaccines in two different mosques, and we were having a hard time filling those up. But once that actually happened, literally 4 days later at our next clinic, they were immediately sold out. And the reason is because there is the cascading effect. So the people got it, and they talked to their relatives, and you know, that spread out in the whole community.
Public health officials are in support of these type of vaccination efforts. Minnesota, we know, is entering a third wave of COVID-19 cases. There are concerns that restrictions are still necessary, even with these vaccines, which can take time, of course, to have an effect. How are you weighing those concerns?
Well, we agree with them. We are requiring separations in our mosques, and we're requiring people to show up with masks. And also, as you know, when Muslims pray, we put our face on the carpet as part of the prostration procedure. So we actually require people to bring their own prayer mat, or we give them disposable paper sheets that they can put on the carpet, because we do not want that to be a source of infection.
You're in Minnesota, as I mentioned, where officials have imposed a curfew in order to prevent violence over the fatal police shooting of 20-year-old Dante Wright. How did that curfew affect your community last night as it began Ramadan? And how are you reflecting with so much happening in your state right now?
The murder of Dante is particularly traumatizing to especially the African-American community. And as you know, in Minnesota, more than 50, maybe 70% of Muslims are African-American. And then the law enforcement response, as is often the case with things like this, is overboard and unreasonable. And the curfew was placed starting at 7 p.m. Mm-hmm. And so there was a period of time when we were scrambling to get through to the governor's office and the commissioner of public safety until they carved out. So there was already a carve out that said there is a curfew, and the people exempted from curfew are those who are traveling to and from work, and those who are expressing homelessness, and those who are fleeing an unsafe situation. So they added those who are going to religious services as a fourth carve out.
The context of all of this is super important. I'm just thinking about the importance of connection. You know, you have been working so hard over the last few months to come to this point where folks can come together in this way during this holy month to be there for each other, something that you couldn't experience last year. What are you reflecting on as you think about all that is happening in the world, in Minnesota, with your individual congregants?
Well, you know, I was at my mosque last night, and I almost came to tears myself, because I had not had 150 people in my mosque for more than a year. And as I was in the prayer service and I was listening to the recitation of the Quran, several times I expressed waves of religious clarity. And all of last year, we were denied that, and rightfully so. I mean, obviously, we had to protect the nation and ourselves and everybody and the whole community from the contagion. But people missed that. I personally missed that, so that this was big for me. Mm.
Well, Imam, thank you so much for sharing what you're doing there in Minnesota, and I wish you the best for the rest of this holy month.
Thank you so much.
Imam Asad Zaman is the executive director of the Muslim American Society of Minnesota.
The latest pandemic relief package includes more than $49 million in federal funds to help victims of domestic violence. Many rape crisis centers have seen an increase in demand during the pandemic, but reportedly from clients seeking help for past rather than recent assaults. Nashville's Sexual Assault Center has found innovative ways to meet that demand and reach more vulnerable populations. Natasha Sanyanovich has this story, which was produced in partnership with the Pulitzer Center and Nashville Public Radio.
The pandemic brought remote therapy to many places, including Tennessee, overnight. But not everyone has the technology, privacy, or desire to connect that way. Others didn't want to enter Nashville's Sexual Assault Center, even with all the safety measures. For those clients, there's a new option.
We've started just calling this whole space the Healing Garden.
Rachel Freeman, the center's president, stands behind the building, where there are benches nestled in green spaces, a playground, a Zen garden, and...
when the weather is nice, there's a fountain that runs.
And large tables for distanced therapy sessions. It's one of several changes that the center has introduced during what Freeman calls a devastating year for victims of sexual crime and trauma. She says the pandemic simultaneously created so many problems and barriers to getting help for them.
But there have been some unique positives that have come along with it.
Outdoor therapy is one. Even more important to Freeman was becoming more culturally competent and inclusive for Black, LGBTQ, and Hispanic victims, all of whom report assaults at significantly lower rates than white heterosexual victims.
It's really easy to say, we serve everybody, and sexual assault knows no boundaries, and we want to make sure that anybody who needs us can feel comfortable coming into our doors.
So last summer, Nashville Center created three outreach teams and expanded their services through community organizations, like the Hispanic Family Foundation. That led to an influx of Hispanic clients and the hiring of a third Spanish-speaking therapist. Bianca Ho says most of her clients are essential workers.
They have to leave their home and they have to work because they're a double-income home.
That's also made Hispanic populations particularly vulnerable to COVID and anxiety. And not everyone has the transportation or childcare to make it to therapy, says Ho. With a laptop provided by the center and telehealth, she comes to them. Teletherapy has been a lifeline this past year, and some even find it easier to open up through a screen or over the phone, says Rachel Freeman.
And it's going to be one of the silver linings that we hang on to post-pandemic.
Each year, Nashville's Sexual Assault Center sees around 1,200 child and adult survivors and their families, many of whom come years after an assault, seeking counseling rather than medical or advocacy services. That's typical, says Terry Poor, the policy director of the National Alliance to End Sexual Violence. There's still a lot of shame surrounding assaults, but the trauma almost always resurfaces, especially, says Poor, in moments of great stress.
Being locked down with not a lot of resources to the things that, you know, make people feel okay and normal was really creating a lot of increased symptoms of trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder.
Poor says many rape crisis centers nationwide have seen a spike in clients in these acute crises. But the primarily nonprofit organizations have limited budgets, so wait times for therapy may be months long, which is why last fall Nashville Center hired a new therapist to offer short-term crisis care to individuals and groups. It's cut their wait time for long-term therapy by a third. Poor applauds the center's innovations, but she still worries about all those who aren't coming forward about recent sexual assaults.
We know even during non-COVID times, it's 20% of less of victims that actually report officially to like law enforcement and that sort of thing.
In the pandemic, says Poor, fears of getting the virus in clinics or police stations may be why some cities have seen fewer requests for forensic rape exams. Not Nashville. The nurse practitioners who perform them, including at the Sexual Assault Center, are still averaging a patient a day. But Pam Cruz, who heads the city's forensic team, has noticed one difference.
The overwhelming majority of victims I have personally seen this year since COVID started know their assailant. It's a friend of a friend, it's my spouse.
According to the Department of Justice, so-called stranger rapes comprise about 20% of all assaults, often following encounters at bars or parties. But with social distancing, those interactions dropped significantly, while overall stress increased. And most abusive people react to stress with more violence, says Rachel Freeman, against those closest to them, which is why she and her colleagues are bracing for a surge.
This pandemic is going to have a long-term negative impact on the lives of victims and survivors of sexual abuse that we can't even wrap our minds around at this point in time.
But Freeman says they'll keep finding new ways, and hopefully even more new funding, to meet those needs. For Here and Now, I'm Natasha Sinjanovic.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.